Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 285. I'm your host, Steve Raker, from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Kevin Whirlwind X up in Canada, and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit in Cincinnati. No, he's in L.A., of course, but we bring him to you via the Comic Book Bunker. What's up, guys?
285, is that like the gang war issues with Amazing Spider-Man?
Ah, might be. Getting there. Getting into the close to the Michelini McFarlane stuff.
Yeah.
Marvel Noise is the podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. But we do have a Facebook page, and you can find us at Marvel Noise on Twitter. You can listen to us on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, the irregular show where we talk about the indie books we're reading. And we welcome listener contributions and new segments, too. Why not? You can find archived episodes on marvelnoise.com, as well as new episodes, too. Right? Right. Holidays are coming, guys. We talked about our end-of-the-year stuff, kind of looking at our year in review last time around. So I thought maybe this time we would talk about a couple of, maybe some holiday Marvel tales, if you will. Hey, first, today on Facebook, funny, on the Back Issue magazine from Tomorrow's, they have a Facebook page that has of the Foom generation conversation, which is great because Back Issue covers, you know, 70s and 80s comic books when it's, you know, focused on its core mission, at least. And on their Facebook page today, we were talking about Marvel Age, I guess you could call it magazine, but it was a comic size comic, right? And I happened to mention that that's the one comic that I sent a letter to and had printed. And another fellow asked me, oh yeah, what issue? And I was like, that's probably something I should know, right? I don't remember. But he went out, and a few minutes later he dug it out and sent me a clip of it.
Nice.
From Marvel Age 16 in the spring of 1984.
You weren't embarrassed?
Yeah, well, a little. They had edited my letter some. It still holds up to this day. I said, Dear Marvel Age Magazine, I collect 31 of Marvel's titles, not counting special editions and epic titles. I just wanted to write to say that you guys are doing a great job. I'm 13 years old, so I wasn't around for the early years of Marvel, but comics taught me to read when I was young, and I've stayed with them ever since. One thing, who writes the answers to our letters? And they just smart-alecky replied, oh, they just seem to write themselves, really.
Interns is what we've come to learn.
The assistant editor, for the most part. Although occasionally the writer will step in there, right?
Well, remember there's stories about that was the Claremont's first job was just answering lots of letters and stuff. So.
Yeah.
Not maybe the people you'd want to, but why not? The illusion is maintained. Still, that's a pretty erudite letter once they took out all the expletives.
I was surprised it was Marvel Age 16. It's like, ooh, yeah, that's early on. Anyways. Hey, do you guys watch any of the Marvel cartoons anymore?
I think I've been more consistent with Ultimate Spider-Man. Of course, there's a six-month gap. So, I sometimes see Christmas shows in, like, March.
They just fired off the Christmas episodes of the Guardians of the Galaxy and Ultimate Spider-Man versus Sinister Six, which is what the current Ultimate Spider-Man season is called. And the Ultimate Spider-Man versus Sinister Six episode, I had to kind of share with you, it was on the 17th, it aired on Disney XD, and it was the Moon Knight before Christmas.
Yes, I still want to see that.
It was interesting. It had Spider-Man, he's stuck over the holidays agreeing to house sit for Doctor Strange with a tree that hates him. And there's this girl outside who needs help, and Moon Knight's pursuing her. And it's Moon Knight with the Declan Shalvey costume with the silver breastplate over the black jumpsuit.
So it's a nice costume.
Yeah, it's pretty current. It wasn't Mr. Knight or anything, but... Moon Knight fights, and his voice, though, it's so... I don't know if they did this on purpose, but it sounds like Will Arnett doing the Lego Batman voice.
Whoa!
And it's, like, deep, and he's speaking all kinds of cryptic moon talk. What's that, Moon? Oh, yes, Moon, I'll do that for you. I'll do that. What will you have me do, Master Moon? That kind of stuff. It's really funny. Spider-Man fends off Moon Knight and brings the girl into the Sanctum Sanctorum, where she's protected along with him from aggressors because of Strange's protective spell. But that's just what the girl wanted. And after a nice montage of her and Spidey doing things like making Christmas cookies that get up and walk away because they're in the, you know, Doctor Strange's world, so the dough is haunted, the girl sneaks into a room that is an armory of villains' weapons and stuff. And in there is Mysterio's helmet. And she goes for it, and she all of a sudden shows that she has some mystic knowledge and reveals herself to be an older, like a young adult, not a little girl. And it is Mysterio's daughter. And she puts on Mysterio's helmet. And in that world, the Ultimate Spider-Man world, the Mysterio helmet actually, he made a deal with Dormammu. And it calls forth real manifestations, it's not illusions that are being called forth. So she gathers that helmet and wants to, use it, and use it she does to make, like, snow monsters and giant gingerbread men and stuff, and Moon Knight and Spidey have to fend that stuff off. And again, Moon Knight's doing all this creepy, being distracted by the moon telling him stuff and whatnot, but it all falls into place because Moon Knight gets led by the moon to this dagger-type thing in Doctor Strange's mansion. He shoves it into the head of the helmet, and I guess it's going to trap her in the helmet or something along those lines, and Spider-Man wants to save her if possible. And to get Moon Knight on his side, he himself pretends to be hearing things from the moon. So he's like, what's that, Moon? What's that you're saying? Okay, you want to rescue, save the girl at all costs if she can be saved? All right, let's do it. And Moon Knight's like, the moon's speaking to you too, that kind of a thing. And that gets Moon Knight onto Spidey's side of not wanting to have her be collateral damage. Spidey gets sucked into the helmet, and in there, trapped also, is the original Mysterio. And in the end, he manages to pull both her and the original Mysterio out and save the original Mysterio. It was interesting little, it had the Christmas, good feeling at the end kind of a thing. And of course, everything's all snowy and whatnot. And the Moon Knight touch, I mean, the voice thing was just, it was hard to get over. But at the end, it was funny. It ends with Moon Knight calling Spider-Man a weirdo for something he says, like, weirdo. When Moon Knight's been the weirdest dude all, through the whole episode. Worth checking out.
You know where I am in Avengers Assemble, Steve? I finally got to see the Masters of Evil. They're not the Thunderbolts yet.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
That's exactly where I am, so I'm getting there.
You got some good Black Panther stuff coming up, and Inhumans, and...
Yeah.
Except they do the Terrigen Mist. They do the cloud thing.
I don't know how much of that I'll watch because, I don't know. I found the Avengers one is probably the weakest show.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, so it was just cool seeing Moonstone and Screaming Mimi and Goliath and the Fixer all on the screen at the same time.
Wait till you see him as the T-Bolts. All right, give me some holiday Marvel tales. Who wants to step under the mistletoe first?
Oh. How about how Fin Fang Foom saved Christmas? It's from Marvel Holiday Special 2006, number one. Also on Marvel Unlimited.
Nice. There are a bunch of holiday specials on Marvel Unlimited, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
That's great.
Like, they have a few stories in here, but it's a Foom story. And it's basically like that special where he was cooking in the kitchen and everything. Like, it's Roger Langridge and all that type of stuff. And I burst out laughing because by the second page of this one, because like Wong's like walking through the city. He's like, oh, this place is real different from where I grew up. Like, there's fewer llamas and all this stuff. And then eventually he runs into Foom and, like, he has a scarf. He's suffering a bit under the weather, and he has a coat and everything.
He's just trying to get through his day.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh, miserable humans and all that stuff. And then Wong's just like, oh, no, it's Foom. I remember reading about this guy in the ancient texts. He's like, he was battling all these guys, and one of the guys apparently Foom was fighting was Tic-Tac-Doe.
Oh, no.
So once I read that, I'm like, wait a second, Tic-Tac-Toe? And I was just like, lost it. So Wong ends up following Foom as he's making his way through the city. It's very Christmassy. There's like a Santa, like a giant Santa on like the back of a truck coming down the street, but it's not just a regular Santa. It's actually Hydra. So they switch on this little thing here, and instead of it being a regular Santa, it turns into like a Hydra Santa. So Santa starts screaming, "Hail Hydra!" and all this craziness.
First Captain America, course, now Santa.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Hydra Santa's like, "Christmas is canceled." So of course Wong tries to go get Foom to help out, and he's just like, I don't care about people. I'm not getting involved in all this stuff. So, of course, Wong gets beaten up by the hordes of Hydra eventually. So, Foom's like, I guess I got to do something. He doesn't want to see someone getting beat up on their own. But eventually you get to this point where Hydra meets Hydra. Like, they defeat the Hydra Santa, but then, like, this other group of Hydra, it's like every different neighborhood in New York has a different Hydra group. And they're just like, what are you doing? That's not how Hydra operates. You didn't even say the phrase properly. They're like, immortal Hydra? Eternal Hydra? Like, your costumes are slightly crazy. So, of course, Foom gets them to all fight. And then everyone sort of goes on their way, and Wong's like, oh, you could come, you know, have a meal with us and everything. And, of course, Foom's not having it. And then there's also some theatrics when, because Foom has a cold, so when he's sneezing, he's, like, sneezing fire out of his nose.
Of course he is.
So it ends the story with him saying, yeah, he wants to be alone, have a warm bath, and some whiskey. And of course, it ends the story with Finn. You know,
that's funny. The conflicted Hydra factions made me think of that scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian, where they're sitting around and they're saying, "You know, we're the People's Popular Front of Judea." No, I thought we were the popular.
The people's. Yeah.
No, those guys are the People's Front. Oh, splitters.
They have two other stories in here. One of them sort of like an A is for Annihilus, a B is for Baxter, that type of thing. You know, D is for the devil. So it's like a thing Annihilus type of story too, which is all right. It ends up with the thing in Annihilus watching a TV series and then falling asleep with some pizza, some beers maybe. Reed and Sue come in and they're sort of like, wait, what's going on here? Now, you know, X is for X-ray machine. Y is for yak butter massage oil.
What? They couldn't think of a Y thing, obviously. Are these the same people who made the cool-o-meter?
It would have been nice if there was a cool-o-meter in here. And then they have another story with, of course, like MODOK, because, you know, MODOK needs to show up with AIM in one of these. He seems perfect for, like, a Christmas type of story.
Yeah, learning the lesson of Christmas. Sure. You love Fin Fang Foom as much as I do. I have been meaning to go back and read a Fin Fang Foom story that I really only read once when it came out on the stands in the 90s. Early 90s, maybe? But was one I'm wondering if you were interested in going back and reading sometime for the show is John Byrne and Paul Ryan's Iron Man run. I think it was the March towards 275, I want to say.
Yeah. Isn't that a Mandarin story?
It's a Mandarin story, but it ends with a big Fin Fang Foom thing.
Yeah.
But I've been meaning to reread that one.
Yeah. I sort of remember that Busick did a late 90s Foom story, too, and he called the story, I think it was like Scale Model or something. He was having fun with the whole naming of stories.
Andrew.
I was going to say, I think I remember that story, that Iron Man story.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed Iron Man. Oh, but you're right. Like, when's the last time you cracked open those old Iron Mans for a spin through that era?
Exactly.
But it was all good fun. All good fun. I thought I would take us back to the frosty old days of 2016 with the Power Man. If you can remember back that far, boys.
What? You're the classic guy.
The Power Man and Iron Fist annual number one, Sweet Christmas. I thought this was appropriate given that we recently covered a Christmas issue of the original Power Man series.
That we did.
But this is the David Walker, and on the art chores are Scott Hepburn, Matt Miller, and Clayton Cowles. And this one is Danny has dragged Luke out to go shopping for the hot new toy. And the hot new toy is this Schnucky, and it's a Pokemon-type ripoff. But it turns out it was all an evil ploy, and it was an evil ploy by Krampus to take over the world, and because all the kids want these toys. So who should also appear but, of course, a son of Satan himself as the team-up, and they have to take on Krampus. And they also have Jessica Drew shows up because she's doing some bonding with Luke about having parenting troubles. Mm. So the four of them have to take on Krampus. And then, you know, they explain that St. Nicholas had defeated him previously. And it goes down to them trying to call on St. Nicholas again and fighting and down to the end. And I think the art, I wasn't super familiar with Scott Hepburn, but I really like it. It's very, like, the mask has a lot of, when Danny has it on, you know, they do that thing where it looks like an actual mask. I mean, sometimes I don't always like that, but in this one, I think it kind of works with the gritty feeling, and I think he does a really good Krampus, too. There's a full page spread when he changes from his human form into Krampus form.
Yeah,
and I also liked the Son of Satan character is always good fun. You know, he's kind of that hero, not really a hero combination.
And he appears here wearing a Santa suit.
Yeah. So, this is a new one, so, you know, I hope I didn't ruin it for too many people. But it's a fun, it's the new annual from them, and it's kind of standalone-y. Like, you don't really, I mean, I think you could probably figure out the characters that have kids, but that would be the only thing I would say that's a little bit, like, out of continuity, and you'd have to know the Son of Satan or whatever. But I think you could pick this up without being into the Marvel right now or Marvel soon to be now or whatever the current continuity season thingy is called.
I was just flipping through it while you were describing it. I like the Krampus design. I like it when the Krampus has got that feral aspect to it.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, this is a really fun, like, for a artistic team I hadn't heard of. That was like the classic goatee kind of evil Krampus, and the little Pokemon creatures they destroy is good too. But yeah, yeah, it's kind of an ugly, I hate to use the term, but, you know, he's not afraid to make the characters look kind of squinty and nasty looking, which is how it should be. But also, there's a nice, all the creatures are attacking all over the world, and I like his Medusa as well, because that kind of line squiggly work looks great for someone with all that hair, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's also one and done, and it's not tied into, like, you know, Age of Atlantis or whatever. Whatever the current continuity crossover silliness thing. You know, they used to work them annuals into the whole side storyline where you'd have to see, buy them all to see, you know, watch Namor fight the Red Skull or whatever, and then get the other issue to cross it back. I like when they're just, an annual should just be its own thing.
Unless it's not.
I
like that, that they call it both an annual and a Christmas special, rather than having it be a Christmas special and every other book having an annual and you're just like, okay, that's the annual for, you know what I mean? Like they do that, they've done that in the past, have like a summer special or a super special or something along those lines, and you realize that it's, or the giant size, and you realize it's the annual for that book that year. Why didn't they just call it an annual? Because they had an annual, you know, a couple of years ago, and they're going to have an annual the next year, so it's just easier to keep those annual issues as annuals.
Exactly. People don't understand what an annual is anymore.
it's a functional label, folks. All right, I got to take you all the way back to 1982, even before my letter in Marvel Age. And I've spoken about this issue before. I bring it up whenever possible because it was a formative reading experience for me as a youth. It was an anthology issue. It was the last issue of a series. It was the last issue of a Marvel magazine, one of the Marvel black and white mags. But this one was comic book sized and in full color. And just in time for Christmas 1982, when I was 12, it's a special Hate the Holidays issue of Whoa. Bizarre Adventures. It's Bizarre Adventures number 34. It's not for kiddies. We mean it. It says so right on the cover. The cover features a Joe Jusko-painted skeleton Santa coming forth from a glowing hot chimney. And already I was like, this is going to be great. It says a Marvel weirdness across the top in the same type of logo that it would normally say a Marvel magazine. And again, this was the last issue. Denny O'Neill was the editor at the time before he would go back over to the Distinguished Competition. Actually, he was just back from the Distinguished Competition, and he was would hang out for right until about 84 or 5 or so before he would go back to DC. But this is an anthology issue, as most issues of Bizarre Adventures was. But the story that I wanted to mention is the 18-page lead story written by Mark Gruenwald with some of the best artwork, line work, detailed background work and everything that I've seen from Alan Kupperberg, who I'm used to seeing doing, more slapstick, funny stuff where he's being a little bit more, you know, immediate with his brush and throwing things down because he's, you know, doing stuff, fill-ins or stuff for Crazy Magazine or something like that. Although occasionally I get Alan mixed up with Paul Kupperberg. But here, Alan Kupperberg does fantastic work. And like I said, it's all full color, this issue, so it's pretty neat. But the first lead story by the two of those guys is Son of Santa. And it starts out with a 18 or 19-year-old fellow who is really on his last legs. He's in New York City. It's just before Christmas. It's snowing out. He is longingly looking into a food establishment. He's hungry. He doesn't have any money. He's wondering how he's going to scrape up his next meal. And he is bumped into by this little fellow who says that he's a Japanese talent scout who's always looking for good-looking American youths to use in their movies as American fill-ins, which then they would dub in the lines and all that sort of stuff. And here's a ticket to Japan and $1,000. And come on, here's the opportunity of a lifetime here. And he's like, if you throw in a hot dog from the, you know, from the corner vendor, I'm in. And sure enough, he gets a hot dog and he's on the flight with this little guy and he's sitting on the plane. And all of a sudden the guy, the smaller guy, he gets up and whips out a firearm and hijacks the plane. He says, everybody stay where they are. No one's going to get hurt. And he grabs a parachute to him and to this adolescent that he's picked up here, this young man. And he says, put on the strap. And he says, count to 10 and pull the ripcord. And he kicks him out the door and he jumps out after them. They are bailing out over the North Pole and descend into the Arctic wilderness, the best that the coloring of the time can show, like the Northern Lights and stuff like that. And they march along, hiking along to this destination. And of course, the young guy is like, "This is crazy. We're going to die here." And they get to this very John Byrne Savage Land or looking dome with snow over the top of it, but it's all busted up. And the small guy is like, "Oh no, oh no," and they rush into it, and the place is torn apart. There's broken toys and frozen people, little people dressed like elves, and dead reindeer all over the place. And the smaller guy that he's with, who, I mean, we've figured it out now, he's an elf. So this elf guy, he's like, "Oh my gosh, he's even breached the inner sanctum," and they go into this portal, and there's a neat mix of mechanical stuff with classic imagery here. They go through this mechanical door, and there's a frozen dead Santa Claus inside, and the elf is grieving and explains to him that, "Hey, listen, 18 and a half years ago, Santa and his Mrs. Claus had a baby, and Mrs. Claus died the next year. Santa couldn't raise you himself and put you up for adoption, and you're the son of Santa." And he's like, "No, this is crazy. That's impossible." And he says that if you're cold, put on the extra Santa suit, which he does, and he immediately warms up. And the problem is they're being been attacked viciously by Santa's arch enemy, the Anti-Claus, who appears and announces that he's coming to town. And the Anti-Claus comes in on this, like, sadistic sleigh, drawn by these warthogs with spiked collars with the tusks and everything, and he's cracking a bullwhip, and the elf runs off, and now the son of Santa in the Santa suit has to run off and defend himself, and he tries to defend himself, but the Anti-Claus is a really powerful dude. And long story short, he's on the run, and he ultimately finds Santa's sack, looks inside, and realizes that it's like a dimensional portal, that it seems almost infinite inside, even though it seems like a sack on the outside, and he uses that to ensnare the Anti-Claus, capturing him, and then has to take on the role of Santa with his one elf who will help get things set up and hire new help and stuff, and two reindeer survived, Donner and Blitzen, Santa's best flyers, so they're going to start things anew. And the first thing they do is take off, and the son of Santa says he's heading for the Bahamas. He's going to do things a little different than his predecessor and set up shop in the Bahamas. He doesn't know what Santa was thinking of this North Pole stuff. And it ends with, "So listen, folks, if you don't get the present that you like this year, give me a break. I'm new at this." Ba-dum-bum.
When you mentioned the hijacking, I thought he was going to say, "Take this bus to Cuba."
Bizarre adventures.
That is a bizarre adventure.
I don't remember that comic at all for some reason.
I mean, it's basically like a one-shot because it's the only color comic-sized version of Bizarre Adventures, and everything else is an oversized mag, you know? It also has a Paul Smith drawn, Stephen Grant written Howard the Duck tale in here. And my favorite at the time was I think it's about 8 or 9 pages, story written and drawn by Mike Carlin, who would go on to be, he was Mark Gruenwald's assistant editor at the time, but he would go on to be DC's editor-in-chief for a long time. And it was called Sleigh Bells, with the sleigh written, you know, like S-L-A-Y. And it's a kid whose dad looked out the window to see what was a chatter, and Santa fell off the roof and caught the dad's head and pulled him down and landed on top of him and killed him. So the kid is all messed up, and he goes around, like, killing all of the Santas that he sees on the street and awaits for the real Santa, who at first is really surprised by the surprise sneak attack, but then is like, you know, "Forget this, man," and Santa fights back, and it's a ridiculously bloody story, and it's funny because it's black and white, except for there's one pink color for anything that's supposed to be red, but it's not red, it's pink, and it just makes it weird. All the blood and Santa's uniform and everything, it's crazy. And at the end, the Easter Bunny's egg lands on his mother. So, the cycle begins anew. Ah!
Don't mess with the Easter Bunny.
Do you guys have any other Christmas offerings, or should we wrap this up?
I had one quick one, like a short one. Incredible Hulk 378.
Ooh.
That's a Peter David, Bill Jaska, yeah. Jeff Albrecht comic, and that's Rhino plastered.
Yeah, I can picture the cover right now.
So what I like about this team, it's also like the really kind of looks almost like a junky Rick Jones version, you know, like the kind of thin and still muscular, but kind of, like I said, looks like he's got some problems. And this one is the Rhino's down on his luck, and it's Gray Hulk era too. So the Rhino ends up posing as Santa Claus, and it doesn't go over well because, you know, the Rhino doesn't have the temperament for it. And also, if you look really closely, the Santa hat sort of covers it, but not really. And some kid pulls off his beard and reveals it to be him. And that's when Gray Hulk steps in. And, you know, the Hulk-Rhino is a classic combination of bad guys. This one is just like a silly, you know how Peter David, well, he can do drama also, like some silly issues too. But if you want to see two gray-skinned people slugging it out and one dressed in a Santa suit, you can look at this. But then a little girl is like, Santa, why are you, you know, beating up the Hulk? And that seems like, you know, a kind of an odd thing to do. And then they end up not fighting and working together, and as Hulk is like the assistant to the other Santa. And Rick Jones ends up getting like kicked in the shins by a kid too at the end of the story, because he's telling the story of the whole thing. And then, like I said, it's like a Christmas issue. You know, they are never serious. They're always just some goofy, silly thing.
Funny. That's good. I remember that one.
Yeah. I think my earliest Marvel Christmas issue is probably that Iron Man issue. I probably brought up before where it said Ho-Ho Homicide on the cover. Santa again, violent Santa.
That's funny. Isn't there a Spider-Man issue like that, too, with us? Maybe the Santa with a gun on the cover or something, or Santa in sunglasses.
Is there a Daredevil with the?
Oh, that's it. That's the one.
He's trying to stab Daredevil or something.
My wife is a big fan of the band The Killers, and they always do a Christmas single for charity. And one of them is the lyric "Don't shoot me, Santa Claus." It's like a whole, like Santa's a gunfighter with the lead singer of the band and everything. So whenever I hear Santa with a gun, I think, don't shoot me, Santa Claus.
Well, with a similar twist at the end to the Peter David story, and it's funny that John Byrne's related to this short tale that I'm about to share with you, because I know how much Byrne and Peter David like when their work is similar. this is a Yuletide fable by Scott Lobdell and John Byrne that appeared in, let's see, what year was it? It was Christmas 1990 in What the Number 10, which was the Xmas special that had Milk and Cookies, characters Milk and Cookies on the cover that Byrne drew. Pretty weird. But this is I'll Be Doomed for Christmas. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through his land Doom's subjects slept soundly in the palm of his hand. A long stocking was hung by the chimney with flair, as always alone, though he didn't care. When suddenly, clang, 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 clanged through the air. My intruder alarm! 'Tis madness! Who would dare? Up to the rooftop, through the castle he sped, visions of battle danced through his head. Saint Nick! What are you doing here? It's my job, Dr. Doom. One evening a year. Now, instead of being naughty, would you mind being nice? You can start by prying my head from this vice. You know, Castle Doom has defenses and everything. Then he passed out from pain, wounded, not dead. And from a red-nosed reindeer came, nice going, tin head. Moments later, back in the castle, Santa awakens and says to Doom, who's standing over him, you know in your heart what you must do. Take my place, Victor. The world is counting on you. Doom pondered and pondered, then asked, "What's in it for me?" "I'll grant you your heart's desire, no matter what it might be." Soon, Doom once again appeared on his roof, startling the reindeer from antler to hoof. "Prepare yourselves, creatures! Away we will zoom! I'm the new monarch of Christmas. I am Santa Doom." The reindeer, "Ho, ho, ho, ho! If you're all done laughing, perhaps we can go. Brace yourselves, beasts. I'm not using his sled. Thanks for the warning." Snicker. "Go right ahead." As the evening wore on, Doom found himself in the States, wondering if he'd be reimbursed for mileage rates. Before he knew it, he wasn't paying attention, Doom alit on the roof of the Avengers' new mansion. "I better be careful. I had better beware. Who knows what security measures could be brought to bear?" Rudolph says, "It's Christmas Eve, you loony. No need to pause. They, at least, knew to expect Santa Claus." Then he squeezed down the chimney, making a mess of the bricks. "Maybe I should have learned some of St. Nick's size tricks." Their tree was a beauty. It lit up the room. Can you believe he was speechless? He? Santa Doom? "Can my eyes believe this wondrous sight? Do they really buy gifts for the foes that they fight?" Littered around the tree are gifts listed to Ultron, and it's like an oil funnel, and there's another one to Kang, another one to Immortus. Doom says, "Now I'm angry. This makes me sore. I've never gotten a gift from the Fantastic Four." He hightails it out of there, and behind him follow Quasar and Captain America. "Doom's getting away. What should we do? We'll follow from afar. We'll keep him in view. He's landing at the fourplex. Should we attack? Let's wait till we see what he has in his sack." Doom delivered the presents, not making a sound. "Ahem," came a voice, and Doom slowly turned around. "Reed, Sue, Ben, Johnny, no need to fight. Merry Christmas to all." "Kapow! Ouch, the thing has some right." Well, they'd overreacted. He'd committed no crime. Rudolph says, "You get the impression it's clobberin' time?" Several miles away, Doom landed in a courtyard. He'd admit he landed quite hard. The heroes approach. "Give it up, Doom. Don't make us get rough." "I've tried to be good, but enough is enough." And Santa Doom fights back. Doom had it up to here with this Christmas stuff. If no more presents were delivered, then that was just tough. In the heat of the battle, it's surprising they heard the sound of a single soft-spoken word. "Santa?" she asked, her eyes bluer than blue. "Why are those heroes beating the tar out of you?" There's a little kid there with a little stuffed animal with an eye that's missing on the stuffed animal. In a moment, the courtyard started to fill with child after child, all looking quite ill. There's a hospital for sickly children sign on the wall. He looked into the eyes of these brave girls and boys. "These heroes are my helpers to help pass out the toys." For one magic moment, they were all of one heart. Doom truly enjoyed playing his part. He held her aloft, wanting nothing to harm her, and the child didn't flinch from his cold, lifeless armor. "I love you, Santa," she says, and in Santa Doom's arms. She whispered as he held her near. Did the king of Latveria fight back a tear? Well, several weeks later, Doom is standing up atop of his castle, and Santa's got his regular garb, and he's up and around again. "Santa," he says, "I'm well enough to leave. Thank you again for your help on Christmas Eve." Doom replies, "Know you this, Santa. I have made amends, and even though we may be parting as friends, when next we meet it will be as foes. Nothing will save you, not even your ho-ho-hos." "I'm Santa Claus, silly. I'm no supervillain. That was fun, Victor. We'll have to do it again." "Oh, One more thing before I retire. There's still that matter of your heart's desire. Thank you anyway. It's been taken care of, said Doom. Then Santa departed into the air up above. I gave him no gift. I wonder what he meant. Rudolph replies, I'm sure I don't know, because that's one twisted gent. The last panel shows Doom hugging the stuffed animal of the sickly little girl with the missing eye. The animal, not the girl. The missing eye. What was his heart's desire? We'll never tell. But suffice to say, all's well that ends well. Santa Doom! All right, I hope you gathered the kids around your iPod for that, folks.
Makes me wonder. I never thought about it, but I guess maybe Santa uses PIM particles to get through every chimney. Well, Marvel Noise listeners, we're in for a treat. We're finishing up the year with the segment you can't get rid of. It's the Thunderbolts time. Justice like lightning. Marvel Noise is most wanted. The Thunderbolt segment returns. Hey! You can hear the crowds cheering far off. And the Thunderbolt segment, what's that? Well, that's where me, Andrew the LA Rabbit, Super Steve Raker from the Bunker, and WWX Kev up in Canada cover the Thunderbolts in all their magnificent glory, starting back from their original appearance, you know, either in Incredible Hulk or Thunderbolts number one. We've covered it all. Their novelization tie-in, limited series, all kinds of goofy, silly stuff. And we've made it up to almost the modern era. Well, I mean the modern era from storytelling, but we are filling in right around the 2006-2007 era. And this is one of our traditional fill-in episodes where there have been a number of exciting kind of tie-ins and one-shots, and this is sort of our Thunderbolts grab bag. But
every time you mention that novelization, you get a chuckle out of me to this day. It never fails. I can't believe not only you acquired it, but you actually read it cover to cover and gave us your book report on it. That was awesome.
I want credit for that. I went whole hog into this. But Kevin, our resident Thunderbolt expert, pointed out that we had missed and we needed our grab bag episode. So, Kevin, do you want to sort of preface this? Normally you give us a rundown on the team, but maybe you could sort of put us in time of where we are and what we're going to talk about.
All right. If you don't want a lineup, I can give you a giant editor's note.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't end the year with all of this, with this loop not closed, right?
Yeah. So we're basically in the new era of Thunderbolt's greatness. and coolness. Because they kind of show up in a lot of places, like Nova. You know, he really wanted no part of the American post-Civil War Marvel Universe. But you know what was more important than the whole universe, right? So the Thunderbolts show up there. The Penance miniseries, What If, Amazing Spider-Man, Secret Invasion becomes obvious as we're going to read on Moon Knight and onward. Like there's a lot. Like the Thunderbolts show up like everywhere. Usually Norman sends them out as the Thunderbolts against someone he has a grudge against. Or like something's going on that he doesn't like. And he's just like, oh, I can really take advantage of this with the Thunderbolts. It's pretty easy to disappear down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, except for Jack Flagg. They just made an example of him. They just picked him. They picked him out of a lineup and were like, ah, go get that guy. Poor guy.
If we had a Thunderbolts podcast, though, I'm sure we would have covered like all those issues in depth. It would have kept us going for years.
Yeah, it would have. But some of those are fairly I mean, it's good that you mention them, but I don't think they're must reads by any sense. Or do you think they're? What? How do you rank them on their importance for a Thunderbolts fan?
Some of them, I would say, you don't really need to check into. Like, some of them are just cameos, but like, the Thunderbolts are major characters in some of these issues. Like, if they're taking on Moon Knight or whoever, they, like, have, like, four issues where they're supposed to bring in Moon Knight. It's just, it's basically more Thunderbolts. You just strip out the subplots and everything, and you put in if Moon Knight had whatever his deal was, because it's his book. But, like, some of those, I don't think they're hugely important, but the Thunderbolts are definitely the main characters in that. Like, the main adversary, like, that's what it was for those months. Also, Atlas shows up in a limited series called The Last Defenders. I guess we're not even pretending, you know, to cover every Thunderbolts appearance anymore. It's like, I don't know if...
I just covered it.
I can even mention, like, every Thunderbolts cameo or... But I should do every Thunderbolts... You know, every issue they show up, I should take a panel of that and tumble it.
In Jim Starlin's Marvel The End, there's a big thing where they look over his shoulder and all the heroes are there and you see, like, the Fixer's back.
So don't
miss that one, Kevin. Starlin drew the Fixer.
I think we probably missed that one. And I think I even led Andrew astray before saying, he was in that contest of champions. And then Andrew's like, no, he is.
Yeah, I read that stupid. I mean, it was a fine comic, but I was led astray. So be warned, Marvel Noise listeners.
In that early internet era, you couldn't always confirm, like, where a character has appeared. You just relied on solicitation text that was obviously wrong later. Andrew, we were so consistent early on, you know, during that first Thunderbolt segment. We got all those issues in. Now we're just letting them all fall away. Like, what happened to us?
Well, I think it's more just the prominence, as you said, the prominence of the Thunderbolts. They've become front and center, a key part. And as the Marvel Universe has expanded, the idea of it being an interlocked universe is even more so today. I mean, I doubt there's hardly any. It's more remarkable when a title is completely standalone now than when it's not plugged into the various events and continuity. So, like you say, it'd be years worth of podcasting for us to follow these down for what I'm going to argue are not essential reading in any meaningful way to get the gist of the Thunderbolts.
Plus, now I'm on board and I'm not going to stand
Thunderbolts. If you had a Thunderbolts podcast, you definitely would want to follow the critical path of where all these characters go.
Are you kidding? You barely wanted to keep reading these issues. I had to twist your arm to get this thing going. And now you're giving me this speech like you would have read all that stuff. Don't be fooled, listeners. I'm going to speak truth to power.
It's true. He wouldn't let us go on unless we covered these issues, but he didn't want to cover these issues.
it's just funny, though, because the Thunderbolts go in and out of, like, being, like, really part of the Marvel Universe and then having, like, 50 issues of side adventures where they don't really tie in with anything. It's kind of hilarious. This is definitely a super tie-in era. But yeah, I thought originally these Thunderbolts one-shots were, like, extra. Like, they were like, oh, Thunderbolts is so popular, like, they need to put out extra material. But apparently the Thunderbolts didn't keep a regular schedule, and these were in months where the regular title didn't come out.
Is that right? I thought it might have been early experimenting of the, like, dual shipping type model, but that's interesting. They literally had fill-in teams doing... fill-in issues.
Yeah. And now it makes sense once I did that research, but of course you're thinking, oh yeah, you know, it's that, but no, it's like Warren Ellis and like already you're thinking, oh yeah, he doesn't put in a lot of issues, right?
Yeah.
So you're kind of wondering, well, is it like him or then, but then you look at the artist and like it's hard to like without doing even more research.
Diodato can do a monthly book.
Yeah, so it seems like the first six issues are pretty well on schedule, and then, you know, you need some one-shots.
Oh, and to point out, these one-shots are on Marvel Unlimited, yay, if you're curious about them.
Yeah,
so
you just have to look them up under their individual titles, I believe.
Right, but they're all under the, because it starts Thunderbolts, it's nice that they're all under the T section. unlike sometimes when you got to hunt and figure out and just go to Thunderbolts and you'll see Thunderbolts Breaking Point, Thunderbolts Desperate. Well, I don't want to ruin the surprise. I'll let Kevin.
There's also, if you were upset or you needed more Thunderbolts, there's also Thunderbolts Presents Zemo, where he takes a crazy trip through his own family's history.
Ooh, hey, don't run through Zemo. That. Somebody made me buy this way back when I was doing it. So this one I actually have in real paper. Listen to that paper and hardcover flipping back and forth. So funny, Steve should mention the novelization. I got to say, the novel was a lot easier to read than Zemo Born Better. No offense to Fabian Nicienza and Tom Grummet and Gary Erskine. We love those guys.
Yep. Yeah. So,
but for some reason, this thing was a hard slog.
Yeah. I don't even have issues of this. I just bought the trade. I don't know. I was so like spent after that long run. I'm like, I guess I didn't want it anymore, right? And I was enjoying the regular Thunderbolt, so I just bought this in trade.
Well, I feel like this story would have been perfect done in the old Thunderbolt style, which would have been compressed as like a running backstory weaved into the regular story. I just think having it all on its own, what happens was when he got pulled in, you know, we saw Zemo was popped into some alternate dimension. What it turns out was he was bonded with the Moonstone fragments or whatever and is traveling through time. But the vehicle they describe this with is this guy writing a thesis on Zemo. And so he's sort of covering the history, and our Baron is going through history, looking at his own family history and influencing it. And it seems like a fine setup, but it just kind of felt, wow. I can't. I tried to. It took me about three times to read it. And there's nothing I can point to where it's like a bad comic booking. It's just, that's a lot of Zemo history. It feels like a textbook. It feels like I'm reading his dissertation.
The Book of Zemo.
Well, it's kind of cool to see Union Jack show up.
Yeah, but how did you feel reading this thing again, Kevin, when you sat down to read it for the podcast?
You think I read this again?
Well, there you go, Marvel Noise listeners. I guess we've proven you don't really need to read this. You can probably cut to the last issue, I would say, if you're really desperate. The guy doing the thesis is connected to Zemo and does this weird blood sacrifice to bring him back to his time. But it's a new reform Zemo who's not super violent anymore.
Oh, yeah, we've heard that before.
So even after all that, we don't even get him turned back to the status quo.
Like I definitely looked through this again, and I really remember the ending where they're like, oh, well, Zemo writes his own destiny, and he can do whatever you want now. And you're like, oh, cool. Like, that's sort of the end of Zemo's story. And you're like, I wonder where he'll turn up next. And you're like, oh, he just decides to be a villain again.
Oh, it's like Doom without the scar.
Like Doom without the interesting plot lines is better. But if you're curious, also on the last page, it does have the history of the Zemo line, if you want to know all the itchy Zemo and scratchy Zemo and Harbin Zemo and all that. So it's kind of... I also wonder if Zemo just isn't a character that can really carry all this much and is better in a more limited dosage. I don't know. Like I said, I can't find any fault with it. It just... I guess you got to be like a super hardcore Zemo guy to get into this thing. And if Kevin didn't bother reread it, he's about the most Zemo dude I can think of.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I read it once, and I know where it goes, and, you know.
Well, maybe 2016 Kevin's different from...
Oh, maybe.
That was a decade ago, Kevin. You weren't going to check in.
I know.
See? So I'm the only guy that suffered through reading this thing.
Well, you need to read it at least once, Andrew.
I took my medicine. I ate my vegetables. So can we move on to the main course?
But that effect behind the Zemo lineage, though, it kind of reminds me of like a 1990s letter column mistake where you have that crunchy image text that makes this handwritten stuff hard to read.
Terrible. Why even have a letters page?
I don't know.
All right, let's get to these super specials. Fill in.
Yeah, let's get to the good stuff.
All right, the good stuff. Thunderbolt's Desperate Measures, is that what we have first, I think?
Yes.
All right, just making sure. I want to go in the proper order here, guys.
I like how Mr. Thunderbolts is asked. There was a time, Kevin, when you dictated. You told Marvel what the reading order was when you disagreed.
Okay, the reading order is Desperate Measures, Breaking Point, International Incident, and Reason and Madness, right?
Yes.
I hope I put these in the right order beforehand. I think so. But anyhow, this one's the... You want to do the credits? I guess you usually do the fancy credits, Andrew.
The fancy credits. As opposed to the, you know, boring, drab credits, we get fancy credits for this one. Well, this is the Thunderbolts Desperate Measures. Paul Jenkins, who is always not afraid of the kind of dark storyline on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise. We talked about some of his Boom work, I believe, which is always kind of a darker one. And a friend to all of us that like the Spider-Man and related titles, Steve Lieber.
Yay. Well,
yeah, that's why I was probably most excited to revisit this.
And June Chung on colorist and Albert Deschenes on letterer. And it's a Bullseye story. And against a fake martial law looking guy.
Well, that's the first thing. When you tell me you have a Bullseye story, I'm already like, oh, like I'm not as interested. So, you know, you're gonna have to work with that. But if you have the AmeriCop showing up, I'm like, oh, there might be a promise there.
I thought you were going to say, but when Penance is involved, then it's even better.
I know. Like, the two guys that are probably more boring, I would say, if you're going to put the focus on them.
Well, why don't you explain who America... I was not familiar with AmeriCop. It was my first exposure. This guy screams 90s, though.
Isn't it a Grunewald type of thing?
Yep. They're going through and wiping out all the Grunewald characters, just like Scourge did once in Grunewald's own book. They got rid of Jack Flagg there, and now it's AmeriCop from that same time. I think it's around when Cap was, like, dying and was in the armor, maybe, or he ended up in the armor as he lost the Super Soldier Serum, and he sort of had to have helpers, and there was a couple of other America-oriented heroes to step up.
And there's a great Legendary Comic Book Heroes ad here of some Marvel Legends, or Marvel Toys, I guess I should say. You have Anne O'Brien, Judge Death, Star, Marv Darkness, Stryker, Ripclaw, Super Patriot, Savage Dragon, Witchblade, Madman, and Judge Dredd. Oh, I feel so transgressive, as Andrew would say.
I remember those. Wish I had gotten the Madman one.
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw the Madman.
So the implication here is that Norman's going to send Bullseye off and Penance, and if those two idiots don't make it out, well, you know, no one's really going to be that sad about it, because AmeriCop's pretty hardcore.
He is.
And of course they have their little... I guess this is their attempt at humor in this book, where they have this little... like disguised, what do you call it? Like, I think I bought one of these toys, like when the Ninja Turtles had some of these things coming out, where it's a little motorcycle with the little side vehicle attached. So, yeah, sidecar attached to it. So I guess that's supposed to be our humorous moment, but I don't know. The book kind of is a little lacking in humor.
Well, what's humorous about it is that Bullseye bails and lets, you know, the bike be a missile with Penance on board. Again, not caring if Penance makes it out alive or not.
And also, there's a lot of snarky images of Norman for humor, too, with that smirk on his face.
And Steve Weaver doesn't disappoint, right? He does a good job.
But this one is, I would guess it's maybe more a penance story, because he ends up getting the one over on Norman by being underestimated by Norman. And they have a little showdown at the end that Penance walks away from, even though now he dresses like a monk or something. I think I've been on record as being, I like Speedball, don't really care for Penance.
Yeah. Same thing.
I could do without either.
Oh, come on. Steve Ditko. Steve. The other Super Steve.
I like Steve Ditko.
Squirrel
like
Girl.
Warriors? Ugh. I'll force Andrew to do that next after he forces me to do Star Wars. It'll be newbie with old B again, the type of thing. We'll have the same sort of relationship reversed.
And this was I thought for kind of a character piece, it was felt like an old Thunderbolt story in a way, one of those character driven ones. Love Lieber, the problem is, I guess, as you said, Kevin, it's Penance and Bullseye, who are two of the characters we're not as...
Yeah.
Well, I'm not as jazzed in, dude, but it was a fun... Like, if you're on the Unlimited, I don't know about dropping $2.99, but I think it's got to be in, like, the 50-cent bin or something, I would guess.
I never see these in the bin. That's the thing. You know how much I go through bins, and I never... I don't know.
I wonder if maybe the print runs by 2006, 2007 are low enough that they're just not being churned out in the same way. There wasn't that many printed.
Yeah, I'm thinking the print runs were probably higher on the main book than they were on these one-shots.
Steve, any thoughts on our first one-shot?
Yeah, I don't mind that having a little side story that takes just a couple of characters and spotlights them like that, and that sort of seems like what we get with each of these one-shots, and I don't mind the choices that editorial made along those lines for these to be the fill-in issues and to handle it this way. Works for me.
Yeah. Some of them end up having more to do with future stories. Like, some of them are just sort of a done-in-one. Yeah,
or get to see different different artists handling the characters, that kind of thing. No subplots, because it just... pretty much is moving through, spotlighting one side story. And they pick on a lot of Gruenwald characters, which, like I said, is always fun. In the next issue, we get Brother Nature. He's another Gruenwald character from the Cap run.
Oh, wait, they didn't make this guy up?
No, from that same time, too, right around the time of America Cop.
Because this one guy is so Huma Sapien and all that, and Plant Man.
Oh, it's got a fun cover, though. This is our Melissa issue with Christos Gage and Brian Denham with Guru FX on colors. So, yeah, it's You Can't Fight Brother Nature, and it's the full squad in this one, but it's a much brighter, slicker palette, I thought, for the colors on this.
Which Denham's art really facilitates, too, and Brian Denham, we're reading one of his indie books, Andrew, that we've done the Kickstarter for, I think, that Airship Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, we are. I did back that Kickstarter. Boy, Indie Noise keeps rearing its suspiciously adult head.
That's Brian Denham.
And here, Melissa, always the field general, always the, nomad for this particular group, talks down Brother Nature, and that's how she ends up getting him in. I do like his line about, I'm a hippie sister, I'm not stupid. And then there's a funny joke about how they're going to do this sexy statue of Moonstone, which was kind of...
Do you remember the statue that was coming out around this time where it was Mary Jane instead and you could buy it?
That's exactly what they were parodying.
Yeah.
Aren't they parodying pretty much every statue of a lady?
But this one was specific where
aren't they
Mary
all
Jane
like
was
that?
Doing Peter's laundry and everything. Right. Like, this is, like, if you don't remember, like, this is,
I remember
almost,
that one.
Like, you wouldn't get it if you didn't see that exact thing.
But my point is, there's an awful lot. It's not like there's one statue like that. There's, last I checked, a whole crop load of them, but that was a fun, and then Moonstone ends up, you know, furthering the plot we talked about before with the swordsman about how she wants to take over. But this is Melissa and her mom reunited, and it feels so good.
I like how they say Melissa appeals to a different demographic, too.
Yeah, me.
Well, they have her statue later on in the thing that everyone's looking at and enjoying. But this idea is Moonstone sort of manipulating the mom to try and manipulate Melissa. But there is a panel where Melissa looks very wasp-like. Like her wings are just like the wasp and she's doing a blast. And I was like, wow, they're kind of converting her over. But yeah, so this is one of Moonstone's head games.
And a mean one at that.
Well, yes, because she... Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Kevin.
It's not like Melissa and Carla get along that well anyway, so... That's why I just, like, sort of love their interactions and head games.
Well, neither of them want to show the other that they've gotten the one-up on them, even though they both hurt each other every time. And it hurt. And it hurts. Each time it hurts each other. You know what I mean? They are like, ah... both from Melissa's side and from Carla's, they each get knocked down a rung by each other all the time, but they never show it.
So you think Songbird's mother is just, you know, totally cool and nothing's going to go down? Like, you know, things will work themselves out, right?
Right, and they have a big blow-up. You know, they get out of here, Mom. You know, you're just trying to leverage my success. And then in the next day, her mom dies in a car accident.
What?
Yeah, that's kind of brutal.
And there was a goblin bomb found inside the car. No. But there could have been.
Probably.
But I do like we get a screaming Mimi Angar the Screamer. Little panel insert again.
Oh, Angar.
You're not going to mention
You're the greatest.
Radioactive Man and Melissa hooking up here?
But they don't.
Oh, that's the thing.
They do intellectually.
Yes.
Hey, she doesn't want to knock in boots with a Radioactive Man. Seems very dangerous.
Yeah,
well, on the plus side, you probably don't need any birth control. But...
Right. You never will again. And it's funny.
But on the downside, yeah.
Radioactive Man played a role in the Desperate Measures one shot too, where he was like following the duo, following Bullseye and Penance, and like lurking around the corner and reporting back to base, that kind of a thing. So I myself had become very fond of this version of the character, and it seems like editorial has as well, as they continue to use him as pretty much the rational fellow, you know. And now you're the guy. He's almost like an everyman in some ways, except for that darned radioactivity thing.
And so, you know, Melissa's been taken down a little bit, but can she handle it? And she wants to go back out and fight the jury with the team. Oh. And the jury is basically a bunch of armored. It's like the Guardians or any of them other.
A Gruenwald
Iron Man knockoffs.
Gruenwald created.
Yeah, I remember them showing up in Spider-Man. They probably wanted to take in Spider-Man instead of Venom. Something like that.
And then Melissa has a feeling that, you know, this whole thing was set up and her and Moonstone have a little vicious shot-by-shot together. And it ends with Melissa having a nasty speech to her that if any, you know, other people's relatives get hit by a car, killed by a rampaging supervillain, or struck by lightning, I'll hold you responsible, and it won't be pretty.
You're right, Kevin. That jury was from that Venom Lethal Protector stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably.
I was thinking it was the... I got them mistaken with the Watchdogs.
Well they throw in a line here about Venom saying, look, I'm not the same Venom you guys were.
that's right.
Yep.
But they seem similar, like U.S. Agent and all those guys would, like, hang out together and everything, so. All right. Then we have an international incident with a big Radioactive Man, the red cover.
This one always makes, whenever we hear Radioactive Man, I always think of that radioactive song that the kids sing now.
Yep.
You don't hear Spider-Man, Radioactive, but you don't hear that?
No.
Okay.
And this is Christos Gage again, the same writer, but Ben Oliver and Jose Villarubio.
Should I say about the breaking point? I think that was my favorite one.
I thought this international incident had some, you know, we all like the Radioactive Man.
Mm-hmm.
He's fun.
But we like Melissa more.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe if they gave the Radioactive Man, you know, a sexier outfit or something.
Oh, jeez. That's a different audience, too.
But and I also like how they also sort of always usually start with them taking on some goofy, you know, unregistered hero/villain.
Who are these guys? Oh, these guys look kind of questionable. Mm-hmm.
Well, they seem to be having not much trouble taking them on until suddenly we find out that they're not regular heroes. What's happening is that they're being experimented on by Arnim Zola. And those old-timey Thunderbolts may remember that's the origin of Jolt, who is on Earth X, Planet Doom. What are we calling that thing?
Counter-Earth.
Counter-Earth.
Doom World.
It's not the real Counter-Earth.
Superboy Prime. What are we... It's just funny how they just sort of let that, like, she had that appearance again, and then they just ship her back.
Yeah,
they go back to that destroyed world. But it's creating an issue because the team wants to go after Arnim Zola, but that involves leaving the jurisdiction of America. And, you know, obviously Radioactive Man's like, this is not right. You know, and that's when Norman drops a bomb about, look, Radioactive Man, China doesn't want you back in the mainland because you're a walking Fukushima. Except that reference wasn't around back then.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a questionable what the real reason is that Radioactive Man is here as an agent of the Chinese government. To keep saying he's there as, you know, on the whim of the Chinese government or at the... request of the Chinese government, at the gracious nature of the Chinese government, all this stuff. Well, it turns out they just don't want him in China because he could blow at any time, they think. So better to send him to America where he could, like, be an agent for us very far from China. And
if he blows up there, right? Nothing lost.
And I like who he gets his confirmation from is the Collective Man.
That's cool. Wasn't there something where, like, he blew up in the Citizen V limited series and killed a bunch of people?
He did. The Collective Man. I thought he was dead, as a matter of fact. I thought he died in that one. Yeah, and he killed Nuklo, if I'm not mistaken, or one of the Council of the V.
Yeah, so they kind of don't want people blowing up in their own country, so I can understand that.
But the team is like, we're going on anyways, and they end up in one of... tracking down Arnim Zola. And while I think our team's good, I don't know. I thought it's a little too almost, not photorealistic, but he has a realistic style that doesn't always lend itself as well to Zola's creatures. I think a more fantastic approach because they're all weird, misshapen monsters.
Yeah.
Or maybe a different coloring take would have helped a little bit.
For the most
part. I don't know if it's... If it's not flashy enough or it's not comic booky enough, it's just sometimes it's just not as, you know, as exciting.
Very few times is there any difference in the line weight. It's mostly very thin lines, thin, dark lines, you know, creating shapes that are colored, and that they're not thick. And there's no scratchiness or any shading or any cross hatching. In the line work at all, so it does look like it. And don't get me wrong, because I've seen other work from Oliver, and I know it's not the case. But it looks like almost like when you're a kid and you trace something with tracing paper. You don't trace every detail and every line. You just sort of get like a very simple single line schematic outline of what the shape is. Well, that's kind of what we see here. Although his storytelling isn't bad. And, you know, part of the problem is when you're fighting Arnim Zola, you're going to get Doughboy.
Hmm.
True, but I like I think in the right, you know, I've always the leader's pink guy. Like those fantastical comic book creations can work. You just need either and also I think the colorist doesn't really. I like either the super flat coloring or the very detailed coloring.
Yeah,
and this seems also kind of right down the middle.
Agreed.
But Zola Arnhem is about to escape. And the swordsman catches him. But we know the swordsman has a, as you pointed out a few episodes back, Steve, cloning has kind of been established in the Marvel Universe. And Arnhem's pretty good at it, so he makes a deal to let him escape if he can create a clone of the sister.
Here's a fingernail. See what you can do with it.
Well, he keeps his sister's skin wrapped around his sword, so he cuts off a slice of that.
Whoa, this is a family show.
Their mutant powers are only when they're in contact. Although it's weird because he's always wearing gloves. So I guess it sort of works through the gloves anyway. So it makes you think, why couldn't he have a glove covering the handle? But hey, you know, whatever makes him happy. But as they strike this deal, the radioactive man pops up and zaps him with a special frequency. I do like how they've really expanded the radioactive man's abilities to be a more thoughtful fighter. Like, he doesn't just nuke people. He uses different frequencies and absorbs power and projects it and everything.
Yeah, that is cool. Just a few months later, when we get the Reason in Madness one-shot, it's the same team, but I think Oliver shows an evolution in his artwork here, where it still has some of the same problems, but in general, I see him take a lot of different shapes and he starts spotting some blacks a little more in his work. Did you guys notice that?
I haven't gotten that far ahead yet. I'm keeping it legit, reading it as it goes.
And then someone from Ghostbusters shows up. This is the Venom issue, in case anyone's wondering.
Well, it ends with the radioactive man lets him go because Strucker points out that, you know, there's going to be a self-destruct item here, and Strucker will blow up the place and destroy this village. And the radioactive man's like, well, it'll kill you too. And he's like, if I can't have my sister, I don't mind dying. And I know you won't let these innocent people die. And the radioactive man agrees. And then when Moonstone shows up, he backs his, you know, radioactive man backs the play of Strucker, and you realize kind of, I think he's been taken down a notch. What I liked about the storytelling is it showed a different radioactive man by the end. I think the realization that his government didn't want him put him in a different headspace.
Yeah, he's realized he's one of them. You know what I mean? He's no better than one of them in some ways now, and now he's going to be, now he's doing the backstabbing and the secret keeping just like one, and here he is. He's really been taken off his pedestal.
And I thought that was a nice, that's why I liked it. I mean, I thought this was a good one because it really, out of all of them, it has the most change in a character, I would say. And it was done in a really clever way. I was like, oh, that's good. But then we do move on to Reason and Madness, which is also Christos Gage and Ben Oliver and Jose Villarrubia. So we've got the team backing it up, but this is, as Kevin indicated, our Venom story.
And Ghostbusters. Or at least Slimer.
Yeah, Slimer, exactly.
But you see how Slimer's pecs are got big black ink spots now?
Yeah.
And you see the shadow behind Swordsman's head is now a big black spot. And on Moonstone's leg, her leg is making a really black shadow.
Yeah.
That's done at the inking stage, not the coloring stage. And as you flip through, you start to look and you start to see, oh, all right. Venom standing with one leg in front of the other one, and one of the leg is all black, and underneath people's chins are all black. He's spotting blacks, and as such, his figures start having more form and more weight, just like they're supposed to.
I still would want to see this with different coloring, though.
Agreed.
To see it, you know,
this is only
how much more I would have enjoyed it or whatever.
This is only like 4 months later or something, or 5 months later, so I think it's already noticeable, though, that it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
I agree, and I'm really surprised this isn't Kevin's favorite because of a cameo appearance in it.
Awesome one, too.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
So Slimer punches Venom, like, blocks and blocks away. Croom. And and he wakes up, and who does he see standing over him? Our old buddy?
David Cannon.
Who is?
Oh, a whirlwind. he's going to make a deal.
He's got the bad armor, though.
Oh, I like that armor.
You do?
What's wrong with this armor?
It's not the we like the anymore. Shirtless. We want the shirtless whirlwind.
No, I'm fine with his armor. I like the helmet, though.
So like he has a deal helmet. Where he's going to inject a short-term blocker of the nanites so that Venom can sneak out that night and meet up with the PhD candidates of evil. We have the bachelors of evil, the masters of evil. We're giving these guys their own title.
Okay. It's funny the amount of times Whirlwind shows up related to Thunderbolt stuff, though, isn't it?
Yeah, he's one of their main cog. Him and Hank Pym are the two connections he has to the Marvel Universe.
He's just not redeemable, so they can never have him join the team.
But I do like how when he finally shows back up again, the swordsman says something snarky to him, and he just punches him in the head. So he injects himself and goes out, and who does he find? Who are the PhD candidates of evil, Kevin?
Oh, Mr. Hyde? Tiger Shark, who... Is this the same guy? Like, wasn't he supposed to have that massive giant fin?
Yeah, he looks like he doesn't look like the all mutated one. You're correct.
Yeah, it looks like he has a costume and he stuck something on his head. Or maybe that's it just shrunk down. He got some surgery or treatment for that. Oh, and of course, everyone's favorite Boomerang.
Yes.
like Superior Foes era.
So Boomerang and Whirlwind, like there's a two-man team up that we need more of. And they have a pitch. And this is the one that one of you hinted at that you'd be totally interested in this Matt Gargan PI comic book.
That was me. Yeah, because they're talking about that. I'm like, wait a second. When did this happen? Is this like new backstory? I like need to go back to the original story and see if there's been mentioned in the original of that's what he was doing, because I was just fascinated by that concept. Like, that would be a book.
Yeah, so they're like, we can free you from this, but we need a favor for you. You know, and then we'll inject you, and then you can either stay with the team or come with us or work whatever angle you want. But it doesn't have to do with you being Venom. It has to do when you were Matt Gargan working corporate espionage and Obadiah Stane hired you to steal Norman Osborn's plans for the military robotics.
Obadiah.
Yeah.
Boy, speaking of Iron Man, there's a classic villain.
I'll say.
Obadiah Jebediah.
But who doesn't like Matt Gargan in the Scorpion outfit? Like, that's always a preferable to the Venom outfit.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, for sure. And that's when I think Steve also mentioned this next crack about we've known each other for a long time. We both wore green.
Yeah, this is the thing with Osborn. He knows all the other Spider-Man foes and everything. So he's always talking to them. Yeah, well, you know when we were hanging out beating up Spider-Man? I watched you on TV and everything.
How many times was it the Green Goblin who was indirectly involved? So, absolutely. And he put together the Sinister Six, and... Yep. Doesn't mean that the other guys like him much, though.
That's true.
So he asked Norman to turn off all his bugs, and they're going to have a secret meeting, and he sets a trap about setting up a meeting with Norman and an inside politician, a congressman, and it's to Norman's advantage if he goes there secretly. But then it ends with anything else, and it cuts away to the meeting. When Osborn shows up, it's the PhD candidates of evil.
I get some good cutting in here, too.
And that's when he's like, you know, the suitcase that he brought with him, And they grabbed the suitcase, and of course, when they put the thing in, it was a, Norman had put a bomb in it. And that's when they're like, Norman's not afraid. And Whirlwind, Kevin, goes to attack him and slices him up, and he doesn't care. In fact,
I would say I do fairly well. Like, I get a lot of good jabs in.
Yeah, except something bad happens to your knee. I'm surprised Steve always loves when people's joints get twisted. Oh, did you like this one, Steve?
Knees don't go like that. Knees don't go like that. And I was thinking that Norman wasn't too worried about being sliced up and everything because he's got that balm in his suitcase. Right? A nice soothing balm.
Yes.
Wrong kind of bomb?
But, well, he's got all kinds of bombs. It's the Green Goblin, and he makes his crack about surviving being impaled. But yeah, there's a brutal, he takes out Whirlwind's knee with, basically puts it at a right angle. I mean, it's hard. And then they all jump in, and he's not afraid. He has these USB bombs, and he throws a bunch into Hyde's mouth.
The more he fights the guys, though, the more he's, like, losing it himself, you know? Starting to laugh like a goblin, and he's, even though he has determined how he was going to take out these guys and has his, technology and his tricks up his sleeve, he's also losing his cool throughout, and you're getting to see an idea of that tenuous hold that Norman has on, you know, being functional.
Good thing one of these guys wasn't named Spider or something.
Yeah, Norman screams and laughs and beats them all up. But it's funny how Venom also helps. He takes out Tiger Shark.
Yeah,
Norman beats up the rest of them pretty conveniently. And then he's just standing over them, ripped up, covered in blood splatch, and just says, this is a lesson. Go out and tell people you do not cross Norman Osborn. Otherwise, he'll kill you. He'll murder your friends, your family, your loved ones. I'll kill them in ways that will make even sociopaths like you weep.
Or he'll just throw your girlfriend off the bridge.
Yeah. Well, as he says, it's water under the bridge anyways. So he and Venom have a little meeting of the minds.
And being reminded that it's Mac Gargan under there, his relationship with Norman is a lot more tolerable, you know?
Yes. Norman gives him a bone by giving one day a month. He'll be off the nanites.
Ooh, could we now? Can we start now?
Just try not to kill anyone who will be missed.
Yeah, and he's like, and Venom's like, I want to be a, you know, Thunderbolt's a better gig than anything else he's got going, so.
Yeah. Oh, he struts off happy. He's like, well, you can tell by the way I use my walk. You almost hear it playing in the background. He's strutting off. He's got the moon behind him. Might as well be like the setting sun. He's psyched.
I mean, while I like the appearance, I don't like that our buddy Boomerang was taken out by an exploding USB. That just doesn't seem right for our man. Who will go on to greater heights.
He might have given up once he saw Whirlwind's knees being broken.
Yeah, he's just like, ooh, I can't have that. I can't throw the boomerangs.
I will stay here in this defensive posture and give myself up.
Pretty much. Well, he knows when to give up and run away, right?
Yeah.
The Punisher shows up, he knows what to do.
Hyde is bleeding out of his mouth. Tiger Shark is unconscious of being held up by his uniform. And, well, Whirlwind's sitting there with a broken leg with Norman stepping on it, making him scream. So
yeah, and then Boomerang's on the ground with his hands on his ears. Please don't hit me.
Exactly. I don't know how taken out he is. I think he's just giving himself up. And understandably so.
Yeah, I think that's a decent enough issue.
Yeah, but it didn't have a big change in our status quo or anything, but I did enjoy it. It was good. But that's our, I think those are all our little fill-in issues, if I'm not mistaken, and we will next time pick back up where we left off, but did I miss any other fillers, Kevin?
Not really. That count, you know.
Then next time we'll be finishing up the Warren Ellis, Mike Diodato run on the Thunderbolts with the Caged Angels storyline, right?
That's right.
Excellent.
So go out and read that one.
And join us, yes, for if I can keep these two boys reading. It's always an uphill struggle, but we're going to keep making our justice a lot like lightning.
Wow, that was a good one.
True that. And next time we'll have some recent reads, some Marvelous Presence, and the Power Man series becomes Power Man and Iron Fist. How about that? I can't wait for that. All right, hope everyone, including my co-hosts here, have a great, light, welcoming holiday and a happy new year. Let's get into it, guys. Let's do it upright.
Glory Nova.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year.
Until the surfer gets Baja shorts from Santa for Christmas, make mine marvel. Later.
Once in royal David's city, stood a lowly cattle shed, where a mother laid her baby. You do well to remember the things he later said. When you're stuffing yourselves at the Christmas parties, you'll love when I tell you to take a running jump. You're missing the point, I'm sure it does not need making. The Christmas spirit is not what you drink. So how can you laugh when your own mother's hungry? And how can you smile when the reasons for smiling are wrong? Messed up your thoughtless pleasures. Remember, if you wish, this is just a Christmas song. Hey, Santa, pass us that bottle, will you?